This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 24th of August 2010, and today I'm honored to be joined on the line by Kevin Ryan, a former site manager for Environmental Health Laboratories, who blew the whistle on the investigation into the destruction of the World Trade Center. He is a co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, a member of the Bloomington Working Group on 9/11, and a board member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Mr. Ryan, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the Corbett Report today.
Thank you, James. It's great to be with you.
Well, back in March of this year, I released an episode of my podcast on the 9/11 whistleblowers that included information on people like William Bergman and J. Michael Springman and Robert Wright and Richard Grove and Sibel Edmonds, amongst many others. But I'm embarrassed to admit that I didn't introduce my listeners to the Kevin Ryan whistleblowing story at that time, and your struggle with Underwriters Laboratory, for which you were eventually fired. Perhaps we can correct that oversight today by having you tell us about your own story and your whistleblowing experience.
Sure, yeah. I worked for Underwriters Laboratories, and I was the site manager, as you said, for Environmental Health Laboratories, the environmental testing division of that company. This is a company that has many types of safety testing going on. And in the case of the whistleblowing, I was provided information by the CEO and other managers at Underwriters Laboratories about the company's previous testing 40 years before of the World Trade Center steel components, and they would have tested them for fire resistance. This is information I was given both verbally and in writing. And it led me to question what happened on 9/11 over time and ask a lot of uncomfortable questions at UL, and ultimately led me to be fired for allowing my questions to become public. So that was 6 years ago. It's been quite a while. And I've done a lot of work since then in further investigating the events of 9/11. And as you said, I'm a member of various groups. I was also the co-editor and still am the co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. And I've done a lot of work looking into how these crimes actually did occur and trying to reveal information that hasn't been seen before.
So then, is it safe to say that the information that you came across at Underwriters Laboratory was what started you questioning the events of 9/11?
Yes, absolutely. It was my questioning how the official investigation, which my company was actually part of, UL had tested floor assembly models as part of the NIST investigation. NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and they were doing the official investigation. And my questions had to do with not only UL's original testing and how these buildings could have failed in, one of them failed in less than 1 hour when the fire resistance test from UL had shown that the steel components would have lasted for multiple hours. So that was the original question. But then as I began to see NIST and UL's testing results as part of the investigation, I saw that they were contradicting their testing results in when they created their reports. And so this caused a great deal more interest on my part and got me into deeper into the questioning of why they would essentially lie about their test results related to the World Trade Center. So, I ended up writing a letter to NIST, and the letter was made public, and that's how I originally became part of the 9/11 Truth movement, per se. Was that letter and getting fired for it 6 years ago.
That's right, and I know since then you've been a tireless devotee to the cause and have worked with people like Richard Gage and Stephen Jones, among many others, of course, in trying to find out more about the destruction of the Twin Towers specifically and some of the other aspects of that day as well. And I know you've done extensive research into the ways in which an explosive demolition of the Twin Towers may have been achieved, and you've looked into such things as some of the world's leading experts on nanothermitic materials and their connection to the WTC investigation. And I know you've also looked at who had access to the buildings in the weeks and months leading up to 9/11. Can you tell us about your investigation and what you've managed to uncover so far?
Yes, I can. You mentioned the connections between NIST and nanothermite experts, and there were there was a list that I published called the Top 10 Connections Between NIST and Nanothermites. And your listeners may be aware of what nanothermite is, or they may not, but it's a high-tech version of thermite, which is a highly energetic material, as it's a chemical mixture of aluminum powder and iron oxide. And when ignited, it gives off a great deal of energy. But on the nanometer scale, nanothermites are also explosive. So the reason that I looked into that is we began as a group of independent investigators to find materials and residues in the World Trade Center dust samples that are still available that indicate thermitic and nanothermic materials were part of the operation to bring down the World Trade Center buildings. And so I started to look at why would NIST have not noticed these fairly obvious things, like all the molten metal, which there's a great deal of evidence for, and the residues, the iron microspheres throughout the dust and so forth. Why would they have not noticed that? And the reason appears to be is that they knew what they were to not look for. Yeah, that's what it appears. With this many people involved in the investigation, for example, the largest contingent of non-governmental employees in the NIST investigation came from a company called Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC. This company has a great deal of connections to 9/11 in general, but they are also a company that are experts at the production of nanothermite, and they've got a division called Applied Ordnance that actually investigated before 9/11 the ignition of nanothermites with lasers. And there's just all sorts of connections between SAIC and the events of 9/11. And actually, even before 9/11, they did the investigation at the World Trade Center in 1993 and came up with the explanation for what happened. So this company is very interesting. And there are other people, professors and so forth, that were part of the investigation that had experience with nanothermitic technology. You also asked about the series of articles that I wrote on who had access to the World Trade Center buildings. And that took me quite a while, about a year, to investigate the different ways. The tenants were one category of people that I investigated. The security companies was another. And then those people who were involved in cleaning up or essentially getting rid of the evidence at Ground Zero was another category of people I looked into there. And I found a lot of very interesting things. One thing I've continued to look into is the company Stratesec, that was one of the major security companies for the World Trade Center, actually tied the whole system together, and they had a contract at the World Trade Center up until the day that the buildings were destroyed. And in my investigation, I noticed that this man, his name is Barry McDaniel, who came in the last 2 to 3 years before 9/11 to Stratesec to become the chief operating officer. He actually came from a Carlyle Group company called BDM International. And BDM International specialized in black operations or clandestine operations for the government, which I thought was very interesting that this guy who came from the Carlyle Group, if anybody knows what the Carlyle Group is, it's a highly Bush-connected company, and a lot of the previous Bush administration officials work there. So for him to come and run Stratesec, the company that was doing security for the World Trade Center, as well as doing security in those previous years for Dulles Airport, where Flight 77 took off, they had a contract for United Airlines, where several of the planes on 9/11 were owned. And Los Alamos National Laboratories, believe it or not, they had a security contract for them. And that national laboratory is one which was developing nanothermite. So I've been very interested in a lot of these connections. Stratesec, I continue to investigate with regard to the CEO on 9/11, Wirt Dexter Walker. So, sorry, that's a mouthful, but that there's a great deal to look into still, and a great deal of information has been revealed in the last couple of years.
Well, it certainly is a mouthful, but it is information that undoubtedly needs to be looked into by anyone who is serious about researching what really happened on 9/11. So for people who are interested about looking into those papers, for example, on building access or the top 10 connections between NIST and nanothermite experts, where is the best place for people to go to find those papers?
Well, the top 10 connections between NIST and nanothermites is found at the Journal of 9/11 Studies as the primary source. And the four articles on demolition access to the World Trade Center are found primarily at two websites, one called puppetgov.com and the other 911review.com. So both, there's all four of the articles I wrote on demolition access, plus an introduction written by author Don Paul. So that's where you can find those papers. You mentioned the 9/11 Working Group, of which I'm a member. We're about to have a big event here in the next couple of weeks in Bloomington. The Bloomington 9/11 Working Group is sponsoring two speakers, Graham McQueen, who's a well-known 9/11 researcher, and also Laurie Manuel, who is a behavioral neuroscientist who just helped publish an entire issue of scientific articles on 9/11. So we're doing that here in the next couple of weeks. And I also noticed I listened to your interview with Aidan Monahan last week about FOIA requests. And Aidan has done a lot of great work on those. We also in Bloomington for the last couple of years have done quite a bit of FOIA request activity. And we've gotten a lot of interesting responses over the years. For example, we received Mahmoud Ahmed's itinerary for the week of September 11th. The days before September 11th, people may know that the General Ahmed that ran the Pakistani ISI, the intelligence service in Pakistan, was in Washington meeting with top officials, and we actually received his itinerary. It was heavily redacted, but it did have some good information and listed a lot of the people that he met with. We received another FOIA response from Maxwell Air Force Base that admitted that they had trained one Mohammed Atta in the years before 9/11, but they, for some reason, hadn't followed up on whether it was the same Mohammed Atta or not. That seemed odd. We received some important data from EPA. We did a FOIA looking for data on environmental testing, which evolved into a peer-reviewed scientific paper, which I co-authored with James Gourley and Stephen Jones in the Springer Journal, The Environmentalist, was published 2 years ago this month, I believe. So we've gotten a lot of good interest, good responses on FOIAs, and I really encourage people, this is something that anyone can do if they just find the forms. If they have a question about 9/11, they can send in a request for any documents that a given agency might have on that question. And the agency, if it's a federal agency, is required to search and make copies of any documents they have related to that and send it to the requester. Now, there may be cost involved, but it's something anyone can do, so I encourage people to do that. What else can we talk about?
Well, I just want to chime in to say that absolutely, I wholeheartedly agree that FOIA requests are an essential part of the investigation, and I think anyone who knows the work of Aidan Monahan or listened to that interview will know just how important it can be. So certainly the work that you've been doing at the Bloomington Working Group as well in that regard is extremely valuable. Perhaps you can tell us about the Bloomington Working Group and how it came together.
Yeah, the Bloomington Working Group is community-based group of activists who noticed that we were all kind of interested in 9/11 here locally, and we went to film festivals and met each other, and we started a group that was focused on two things primarily, the FOIA requests and also presentations given at a local theater here in Bloomington that we sponsor. And we put on for free. So we raise funds. It's a really nice theater here in downtown Bloomington. We have had speakers including Richard Gage and Stephen Jones and David Ray Griffin. And this year we're having, as I said, Graham McQueen and Lori Manuel. So these are really good people that my neighbors that I work with locally. And I think really a lot can be done in your own community because, in my view, you know, it's one thing to read something on the internet or read an article from somebody you don't know, you don't live near, you can't follow up with necessarily. But it's another thing when your neighbors are putting on, you know, they're going to a lot of personal expense and expending a lot of personal energy like we are to try and get out information and get people to think about something that's important really to all of us. That's the kind of thing that makes people stop laughing and stop making jokes about, you know, something so important as this. And they start to listen, believe it or not. And if, you know, you write letters to your local paper as well and just trying to get a community conversation going, I found that that is really effective, at least on the local level. And it gets people to begin to change their minds and look at some of this information.
Well, one of the things that spurred me to get you on the program today was an op-ed that you had published in the Bloomington Herald Times earlier this month on the subject of 9/11. Not because of any new explosive evidence that you uncover in that op-ed, but precisely because it is such a basic piece for those of us who are already well-versed in 9/11 truth. And in that piece, you talk about false flag attacks and why the blowback theory of 9/11 is insufficient to account for things like the air defense stand down and the explosive residue in the WTC dust. And as I say, it's an extremely basic piece for those of us who have been researching 9/11 truth for years, but I think it's valuable precisely for that reason, since it seems that perhaps as a movement we have stopped to a large extent reaching out to the public to try to get them to understand the basic premises that we're working from. And to that end, I think this type of op-ed is an extremely valuable way of getting the word out about 9/11 truth and continuing to expand the movement even as we head into the 9th anniversary of those events. So maybe you can tell us about this op-ed and what prompted you to write it.
Well, this is the second op-ed that I've had published in the Bloomington paper. And the first one, let me give you some background. The first one came after our first presentation at the theater downtown in 2007. And we had some good coverage at first about this event, and then we ended up packing the house. Over almost 700 people came to this free event in downtown Bloomington. And what we ended up seeing then was kind of a recoil backlash from the editorial board of the local paper. They, I think, were shocked that we had such a good turnout and such a good response. They had an online poll in the paper where they asked if people would possibly agree with the local group or whether they thought we were all crazy. And the overwhelming majority agreed with the 9/11 working group, and I think that embarrassed them further to the point where they ended up writing kind of a nasty editorial. And I wrote a guest column in response, and they kind of grudgingly published it. But this is my second, because they've seen, I think, over the years that we're not intentional troublemakers of any kind. We're not trying to tear down our country or you know, anyone who's acting sincerely in good faith. We certainly are not the enemies of any other Americans. So we're just looking for answers because it's so important to us, we feel, and to our children's future to know what happened on 9/11. It's such a turnkey event. And so I wrote this new column and I sent it in, and believe it or not, they published it in less than 2 weeks, just immediately. I was very pleased with that. As you said, I tried to approach this one a little bit differently. I didn't have a lot of the physical evidence or the scientific details in this op-ed. It was more like, you know, let's talk about this buzzword conspiracy that people have used to kind of dismiss the idea of an alternative explanation for 9/11 and talk about the fact that conspiracies are central to our legal system, for one thing. You know, conspiracies are everywhere if you believe our courts and our judges. But what we do with 9/11 and things that are emotionally uncomfortable like 9/11 is we say it's a conspiracy theory, meaning that you know, somehow we've redefined the term conspiracy to mean something where only you know, it's not really believable that people would conspire to commit crimes, and certainly totally unbelievable in this redefinition that any powerful people would ever participate in a conspiracy to commit a crime like 9/11. Of course, that makes no sense at all, and that's what the op-ed was trying to say, but also it tried to explain from my viewpoint what some of the basic commonly accepted theories are like. So the blowback theory, I talked about this idea of the blowback theory, where these poor people who just happen to live on the most strategically important lands in the world, you know, where all the oil reserves are at and the natural gas reserves, those are the only people who can be conspiracy criminals, and they attack us not because they happen to live on those lands, but because we've been bombing them and blockading them for so long. So I say, okay, blowback is one thing. And the really hard line people draw who believe in that blowback theory is that they would never believe something called managed blowback. What I would call managed blowback is where the powerful folks would recognize this kind of retaliation, that these kind of irrational acts of violence called terrorism that constitutes blowback. They would never recognize that this is happening and then trying to leverage it for themselves, for their benefit. That's not in any way possible to the people who believe blowback. I mean, that's what it seems to me, that there's this really hard psychological line between blowback and manipulation of blowback. You know, that I'm just trying to find that spot where people can't go, you know, if you know what I mean, that point psychologically where, you know, everything falls apart with rational thinking.
Yes.
Because if you use rational thinking with 9/11, there's no way you're going to believe the official story. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's just this long string of incredible and unbelievable events. So I'm trying to find that spot.
And
go ahead.
Perhaps another way for people to understand the concept of managed blowback would be to investigate the concept of the strategy of tension, and that would lead people to things like Operation Gladio and P2OG and other such examples and evidence that we have from history of things that are perhaps comparable, or at least help to give a better understanding. But Kevin Ryan, as you well know, we stand here on the brink of the 9th anniversary of the events of 9/11, and as I sit here, I begin to wonder if this brink is in fact a precipice of a sort, because it seems to me that it's very obvious that we are winning the battle for the hearts and minds of the public, with a greater number of people waking up seemingly every day to the truth of what happened on that day, as opposed to the official conspiracy theory. But the further away from the attacks that we get, the harder it becomes to achieve the true goal, I think, of the 9/11 truth movement, which is to see the creation of an independent investigation with subpoena powers. So what are your thoughts on where the 9/11 truth movement stands right now and the dangers and opportunities that this type of anniversary presents?
Well, the 9th anniversary is for some of us, you know, 4, 5, 6 or more years of investigation already. So there's a lot of people who've done a lot of good work who I think to some extent are tiring out. But also there are a lot of new people who are coming along. So the people just realizing finally that you know, they've seen enough. They've seen enough of the facts and the questions, and they also agree that we need a real explanation for 9/11. So I think that there are a couple of challenges at this time, and that is people who are just beginning and still have a lot of energy and want to look into this, there's so much that needs to be done. There's just so much information, that so many questions that need to be answered still. And we can, personally, I believe we can do a lot of that. We don't necessarily, while we're calling for a subpoena-based investigation, have to just let it go. We can dig in and find out things like who had access to the buildings and who potentially could have shut down the air defenses and why was Dick Cheney tracking Flight 77 and lots of questions we could work on. But there, we have to be clear that there's been a lot of pitfalls in the past and a lot of difficulties in asking questions that maybe aren't as valuable and don't get us to justice as quickly, or maybe are intentionally brought up in order to discredit us from within. And so if we can get better at bringing new people along who aren't going to hit those snags as easily, who are going to get past that better, I think that that would help a lot. Additionally, you know, I just noticed this this mosque in at Ground Zero discussion really appears to be, in my view, a psychological operation of some sort, because really not only is it not really a mosque and it's not really at Ground Zero, but the people, the camps that are dividing up, they appear to be arguing about whether or not it's okay for Muslims who committed the crimes of 9/11, who are part of a, you know, the people who committed the crimes of 9/11 were Muslims, is kind of the default assumption. And let's argue from there. So when I see an article in the Washington Post from Karen Hughes, who used to be the spokesman for George W. Bush, who's kind of framing this whole discussion as whether or not it's okay for Muslims who were, you know, the group that attacked us on 9/11, to build a mosque or to not build a mosque, I think we've already seen that this discussion is off base, because if you read some of David Ray Griffin's work, it's a really good way to see some of the many reasons why it probably was not Muslims who attacked us on 9/11. The people who attacked us, who were accused of attacking us, did nothing Muslim-like. And also there are a lot of other reasons. But so what my point is here is that we should watch these mainstream discussions as they come up and make sure that we're not kind of buying into assumptions that are built into that kind of discussion. So that's another thing we can do here 9 years later, because I think you're right. People in who have vested interest in not seeing the truth come out are clear that there are a lot of people questioning 9/11, just a huge number now, and they see people like you and I in their communities, you know, and after however many years, they can no longer just blow us off, because we're not going away. We're still going to be here. We're still going to be asking the questions and sharing the information on the 10th anniversary. And there'll be new people as well. So some of us may drop off our activity a little bit, maybe temporarily, maybe long term. Others are going to step in and bring a lot more energy. So I think that there are just some things we need to keep our eyes out for: the pitfalls of the past, and also the kind of discussion framing disinformation almost that comes out of mainstream corporate media.
Well, that's right. And also the events like these, the Ground Zero Mosque distraction, also give us a chance to re-inject 9/11 truth into the discussion by pointing out things like, well, have we considered who really is responsible for the attacks? So every time they have a chance to bring in just another psychological operation to get people to accept the 9/11 conspiracy theory, that's also an opportunity for us to help steer the conversation in a different direction. So there's always an opportunity with each new challenge. So I do appreciate your overall message, and I certainly think that, yes, we are growing as a movement, and there is so much opportunity for growth. So, Kevin Ryan, where can people find out more about your work, and do you have a blog or something that you can specifically point people to?
I've got several blogs. I blog at 911blogger.com, also at visibility911.com, and occasionally at americanbuddhist.net. So you might find my blogs any number of places. My papers, of course, are published in various sites from the New Zealand News Scoop to Journal of 9/11 Studies. I've been published in Global Research and lots of different sites. I'm not too particular on where it gets published as long as it gets read and it's not associated with any kind of misinformation or anything. So 911blogger.com and visibility911.com are, well, in the future you'll more regularly see my postings.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to those postings, as I'm sure many of my listeners are, and I certainly hope that we'll have the opportunity to speak again and hopefully continue growing this movement, of which you are certainly an important part. So, Kevin Ryan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today on the Corbett Report.
Thank you, James. It was a pleasure.